You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The God of Corrupt Things by Karen Mahajan. The following year, the Guptas moved into television, launching a channel called ANN7 to secure more government ad revenues. Rajesh Sundaram, who became the channel's editor, told me he met with Zuma and Atul Gupta three times in 2013 to discuss the launch. The president, who acted like a secret shareholder in the channel, told Sundaram that he wanted it to disseminate subtle propaganda. ANN7 served as a microcosm of how the Guptas ran their operations, low on quality, high on greed. Laborers were flown in from India on tourist visas and housed in substandard barracks. No one was offered medical benefits. Atul monitored the lengths of employee bathroom breaks and installed GPS in company cars to make sure reporters weren't straying from their work beats. Attractive models were hired in lieu of trained anchors. During the channel's launch, one model anchor froze on camera as she waited for her teleprompter to function. In another segment, an anchor waiting for a transmission from a correspondent was instead greeted by the sound of a backstage technician making an anguished mooing sound. The downfall began, like a Shakespeare comedy in reverse, with a wedding. In 2013, the Guptas decided to throw the wedding of the century for their eldest niece. They booked the upscale Sun City Resort in South Africa, 2 hours north of Johannesburg, plotting 4 days of events for 400 guests. They flew in Bollywood stars from India and dancers from Brazil and Russia. They ordered 30,000 bouquets spread across the volcanic grounds of the resort. A 70s-era version of Wakanda, complete with gigantic plaster elephants. The invitation itself was so imposing, 6 ornate containers laden with delicacies from 6 continents, that when one invitee, the wife of a provincial police commissioner, received it, the local bomb squad was called in to detonate it. Then, on April 30th, more than 200 guests from India began to arrive. They flew not to Johannesburg, but to Waterkloof, a South African Air Force base a few miles south of Pretoria. Waterkloof is a reddish, parched patch of earth with the endless low-lying feel of a college campus. As the bleary-eyed guest disembarked from a chartered flight not long after sunrise, they were greeted by Atul, dressed in a pink T-shirt and dark blue blazer. Atul ushered the guest into 7 helicopters and 60 white Range Rovers for the trip to Sun City, accompanied by police escorts. All of this would have gone off without a hitch had it not been for Barry Bateman, a radio reporter in Pretoria. Tipped off about the arriving guest, he rushed to Waterkloof and walked up to Atul outside the passenger terminal with a simple question: "Why are you using an Air Force base to bring your family in?" Military bases, Bateman knew, are typically reserved for flights involving high-ranking government officials or heads of state. It was as if a wealthy Russian oligarch had been permitted to use Andrews Air Force Base to land hundreds of guests for a private affair in Washington, D.C., one scheduled to be attended by the president himself. When Atul refused to answer Bateman's question, "Don't be smart with me," he said. The reporter immediately tweeted about the curious landing, hashtag Gupta wedding. For the first time, ordinary South Africans suddenly knew who the Guptas were and how high their influence reached. The country was outraged. The Zuptas, Zuma and the Guptas, became a staple of daily cartoons and Trevor Noah parodies. The officials who had orchestrated the landing later said they had received instructions from Number One, a clear reference to President Zuma. The Guptas, meanwhile, were unapologetic. "One day, these officials will know the power of the Gupta family," said Atul. AJ, the canniest of the brothers, felt the scandal would get them eyeballs for their new TV station. Later, leaked emails would reveal that they paid for the wedding using money they had looted from the dairy farm and routed through the United Arab Emirates. KPMG wrote off the lavish celebration as a business expense. Emboldened by their survival, the Guptas kicked their corruption into overdrive. In 2014, Zuma's associates awarded them the largest-ever supply contract with Transnet, South Africa's rail and port company, a deal worth $4.4 billion. The Guptas used the contract to secure millions in kickbacks, which they called commissions, from international players eager to do business with the firm. Zuma also installed four Gupta allies on the board of Eskom, South Africa's power utility, which illegally handed the Guptas $38 million in government funds to buy the Optimum coal mine. Eskom had hounded the mine's previous owners into bankruptcy at the Guptas' behest. If you wanted to do business in South Africa, it seemed, you had to go through the Guptas, much as certain white-owned enterprises had cornered the economy during apartheid. Respected international firms rushed to make deals with the brothers and their associates. McKinsey & Company, the global consulting giant, partnered with Eskom on a scandalous deal, its largest ever contract in Africa, that wound up funneling money to a Gupta-linked firm. McKinsey denies that it did anything illegal. The London-based PR firm Bell Pottinger used Twitter and fake news websites to inflame racial tensions in South Africa, spreading the idea that white monopoly capital was orchestrating the attacks on the Guptas to create economic apartheid. And KPMG, the accounting firm, was hired for $1.65 million by a top Zuma ally to discredit South African tax officials who were investigating the brothers. The firm essentially copied memos provided by the government, portraying the officials as a rogue unit that illegally spied on the Zuma administration and engaged the services of prostitutes during their leisure time. The fake news campaign worked. Several senior tax officials were forced to resign, and scores more quit. Then, on October 23, 2015, the Guptas tried to bribe the wrong man. On that day, a balmy Friday, Misibisi Jonas, the country's deputy finance minister, was invited to a hotel to discuss business with the president's son, Duduzain. Instead, Duduzain drove him to the Gupta compound. There, Jonas later testified, he met with one of the brothers whom he believed to be AJ. AJ told him that the old man, President Zuma, seemed to like him. The family, he added, wanted to see whether Jonas was someone who can work with us. "You must understand that we are in control of everything," AJ said. "The old man will do anything we tell him to do." The deal on offer, Jonas recounted in his testimony, was as simple as it was enticing. Zuma would appoint Jonas as the nation's finance minister. The Guptas, in turn, would pay Jonas $45 million to purge treasury officials who opposed the deal to build Russian nuclear energy plants that would operate on fuel supplied by the Guptas' uranium mine. Jonas, a soft-spoken man with a neat white goatee and a tie that always seems on the verge of coming undone, was outraged. When he got up to leave, AJ tried sweetening the deal. If Jonas was willing to cooperate, AJ said, he would deposit money in an account of his choosing, in South Africa or Dubai. In fact, he could give him $45,000 on the spot. Do you have a bag? He asked Jonas, or can I give you something to put it in? When Jonas again refused, AJ followed him to the door. If he told anyone about the meeting, AJ warned, the Guptas would have him killed. In a sworn affidavit, AJ insisted that he was not present at the meeting, which he calls an intentional fabrication to implicate me in alleged wrongdoing in which I played no part. In March 2016, as the Guptas and Zuma continued to try and bend the finance ministry to their will, Jonas decided to go public. This time, the ANC was unable to brush off the allegations. They came from within the ruling party itself. The Guptas fled for Dubai in April, and the ensuing investigations toppled top executives at McKinsey and KPMG, which is under investigation for its ties to the Guptas, as are HSBC, Standard Chartered, and SAP. Bell Pottinger, the PR firm, imploded after accusations that it had tried to stir up racial resentments at the Guptas' behest. Threatened by a vote of no confidence, and with his candidate having lost the vote for ANC president, Zuma was forced to step down in February 2018. A few months later, Du Dezijn appeared before a judge in shackles, wearing a gray wool jacket and a rakish black scarf, and was charged with corruption. The era of the Guptas, it seemed, was over. Even in exile, the Guptas remain a central meme in South African consciousness. The few available stock photos of the brothers circulate regularly on the front pages of the country's newspapers. On the day I arrived in Johannesburg last fall, a commission of inquiry had begun its investigation into state capture, a brief moment of hope that quickly curdled into disappointment. With a budget of $17 million, the commission was expected to complete its work in 6 months. But the wise, turtle-like judge overseeing the inquiry sonorously predicted it would go on for 2 years. It soon became clear that the Guptas would not appear. It was an open question as to whether Zuma could be compelled to testify, and the government has temporarily withdrawn corruption charges against Du Dezijn, pending further evidence from the commission. On the first soporific day, in a large hall that could have been the foyer of a bank, the lead prosecutor presented such boring PowerPoints that I almost wished McKinsey could be brought back to enliven them. The economy, meanwhile, remains devastated by all the plunder and corruption. Tax collections have plunged by billions since Zuma's purge of the once respected state tax agency. The rand is reeling, and credit rating agencies have downgraded the country's bonds to junk status. A quarter century after the end of apartheid, South Africa has the worst income inequality in the world, evident in the profusion of high walls, electric fences, and guards to protect parked vehicles. Almost two-thirds of blacks live in poverty, compared with only 1% of whites, and half of all young people are unemployed. These young people, like the miners I met at Optimum, are growing impatient. In 2015, a student movement called Rhodes Must Fall successfully pressed for the removal of a statue of the colonialist Cecil Rhodes from the University of Cape Town. Now the movement has morphed into Fees Must Fall, demanding free university education for poor families as a means to self-empowerment, though it is unclear where the money for such largesse might come from. And calls for land reform in a country where whites own 72% of all privately held farmland are also growing. The less the country can deliver, the more radical the demands have become. The Guptas have created an atmosphere of distrust in which ancient group feelings are being resurrected. Many whites, who make up 9% of the population, blame the ANC for the country's downfall and see themselves as victims. One of the first things I heard on the radio when I arrived in Johannesburg was a middle-aged white man calling into a talk show to complain that the benefits of the end of apartheid have been outweighed by the way we're being discriminated against. There was no acknowledgement of the devastation caused by apartheid, or why it might necessitate affirmative action for blacks. In a Cape Town bookstore, at a discussion about state capture between a professor and a government minister, I found an audience full of politically engaged, middle-aged whites, fired up about what the Guptas and Zuma did to the country. But talking to them, I discovered that they were the South African equivalent of Trump's most fervent followers. One 60-something white woman with rabbity teeth, keen blue unseeing eyes, and an orthopedic metal cane told me that poverty in India was dignified, unlike the begging and entitlement in South Africa. Another white woman, overhearing a conversation I was having, rebuked me for not supporting Trump, calling him the only knight in shining armor in a dark reality. Trump himself had tweeted a few days earlier about the large-scale killing of white farmers in South Africa, a patently false statement. How could I tell her that the broadside on behalf of white South Africans was meant to divert attention from Michael Cohen's guilty plea that day? Did anyone wish to see beyond their own narrow version of the truth? Back in India, meanwhile, the Guptas have been slowly raising their profile. When I visited Saharanpur, I discovered that the brothers are considered heroes, though the adulation is shot through with the sort of gossip you expect from small towns, accounts of film stars and politicians visiting the family's home, the difficulty of getting an appointment with the Gupta sister. In one fetid corner of the old city, so cramped that cars cannot get through, I encountered the scaffolded bones of a massive temple with more than 50 rooms for religious education, surrounded by carved sandstone blocks, waiting to be joined together to create shrines. The temple would be complete in 2022. It was the Guptas' $28 million gift to their town. The brothers now live openly in Dubai, though their time there may be limited. In September, the UAE and South Africa finally signed an extradition treaty, mainly, it is thought, to ensnare the Guptas. Undeterred, the brothers continue to revel in their wealth. They recently sent out a 17-page invitation for yet another extravagant family wedding, this one projected to cost $7 million. Under the names of their children was inscribed, almost wistfully, their place of residency, Johannesburg, South Africa. The Guptas, remarkably, seem hurt that their former fiefdom, the place that made them who they are, has turned against them. How they acted so differently. Had they acted so differently from the white colonialist before them? Was A.J. Gupta or Gupta family proven guilty? A.J. asked a reporter recently, employing the third person, one place, one smallest thing? A journalist who met A.J. in India told me that the Gupta patriarch is seething in rage over his family's fall. We've always eaten two rotis, A.J. declared defiantly. We'll keep eating two, no matter what happens. The same could not be said for the starving miners and the looted country the brothers had left behind. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Yayoi Kusama, the Japanese artist who celebrates her 90th year with a solo print exhibition at Shanghai's Ota Fine Arts Gallery, talks polka dots and self-love. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Happiness is when I make a good artwork. What is your greatest fear? Nowadays, the world is anxious with war and many people dying, and every now and then I think deeply about the life and death of a human being. Which historical figure do you most identify with? No one but myself. Which living person do you most admire? No one but myself. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? There is nothing. I adore myself. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Nothing. What is your greatest extravagance? I have never thought about such, as I am constantly busy with painting and thinking about my art. What is your favorite journey? Recently, my only journey is going to my studio to paint. Which living person do you most despise? I feel resentment at artists who forgot how precious creation is and have a life of doing things by halves. What is your greatest regret? I do not have any, as I am responsible for my own life. What or who is the greatest love of your life? I have always been busy with creation and never had the time to fall in love. Which talent would you most like to have? The talent to be able to paint forever. What is your current state of mind? Feeling the final day of my life approaching, I think about becoming a great person, a great artist, and leaving great artworks in this world. I spend every day trying to make all possible efforts that one person can, and I want to do so until this life expires. This is everything that my art has reached. I will keep my struggle to send the message of Yayoi Kusama to future generations until the end of my life. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I have never thought about it. Anyway, the past is in the past. What do you consider your greatest achievement? I am still struggling to achieve love and peace through my art. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Myself. What is your most treasured possession? My art. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? War. My childhood was a miserable one in the days of war. Art has always been my hope and support. Who is your favorite writer? Takuboko Ishikawa. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? I don't have one. Who are your heroes in real life? Myself. What is it that you most dislike? Solitude. How would you like to die? I would like to die in a way that my art would inspire the generations after. I would like to live till the end of my life in this world, filled with endless love and prayers. I am trying to communicate with people through my work, in order that they continue to appreciate my art even after I am gone. What is your motto? The sun, the moon, the earth, and stars are also polka dots. They cannot exist alone. Each and every one of us are polka dots. We gather and weave a beautiful pattern of polka dots. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Yayoi Kusama. on the beat. I love not having rules, says the multi-talented Anderson .Paak, about his latest genre-defying album, Oxnard, his third, and his first for Dr. Dre's Aftermath label. The singer, songwriter, rapper, and drummer is on a headlining arena tour this spring that includes an appearance at Coachella. Here, .Paak, 33, talks about his chaotic upbringing, marijuana, and church, by Lisa Robinson. How did you become such an accomplished drummer, playing in church? Church was the best schooling I could have had. You can't learn it the same way going to college or paying for it. It's a spiritual process. The strong faith, the culture, just feeling the groove, feeling the choir out, knowing when to switch it up. It's reflexes, instincts. You went from playing music in church to working at a weed farm, which seems like a weird seg. It's natural. God blesses us with the herb. I was doing God's work. But now I have to take breaks from weed because I get the munchies and gain weight. I once had a bad experience with edibles on a plane. I had a legit anxiety attack. My heart was racing. I thought I was going to die. Everyone was looking at me like I was on crack. Your music has no boundaries. There's jazz, soul, funk, rap. It's not interesting for me to make an album that's one thing or some retro thing that's been done before. I'm trying to keep it exciting for myself, for the people around me, and continue to get better. I love embracing all the genres people said we couldn't. On Oxnard, you have features from Dr. Dre, who also produced a lot of it, Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, Snoop Dogg, Busta Rhymes, Q-Tip, and others, who got all of them to participate. That was me. These people don't have to answer the phone for anybody. Everyone is trying to work with them, but all of them came out of real relationships I had. I wanted to get the best artist I could. I wanted to go big with it. Your career is really taking off, and you're married with two kids. How do you balance that? A lot of myself is given to my music now. It's an obsession. If I didn't have my wife, I don't know how things would go, but I know that someone is there who's nurturing and taking care of these kids while I'm touring, and my two kids are mama's boys. What is .Paak House? It's the first initiative from my Brandon Anderson, .Paak's real name, foundation. I do stuff in my hometown, Oxnard, California, for low-income families. Eventually, I'd like to have a .Paak House in every city in the country, like the Boys and Girls Clubs. Your upbringing was chaotic. Your parents were both in jail. You've seen domestic abuse, yet you seem so happy. How are you able to make such uplifting music? Maybe because I went through a lot of chaos and drama, I find humor in a lot of things. But I feel that things could be worse, and as long as you're breathing, you can smile. Even when I'm angry, I smile, but the smile can mean 10 different things. You have amazing teeth. Are they real? Yeah, they're real. I had braces when I was younger. I try to brush twice a day. I've got to maintain this reputation. I've got the best teeth in the game.
Thank you.
Crime Journal by Don Winslow. The Chapo Trap. Sold as a major drug war victory, the El Chapo trial was really just business as usual. Don Winslow was the best-selling author of The Cartel, The Power of the Dog, and The Border. Illustrations for this article by R. Kikuo Johnson. Opening illustration, Guzman was one piece in a complex machinery involving both drug traffickers and police. And this illustration shows them all working together, with Chapo in the center. It was the trial of the century, right? The satisfying third act in the dramatic rise and fall story of a celebrated mob boss who became one of the world's richest men, a Robin Hood who gave to the poor, a modern-day Houdini who escaped from not one but two maximum security prisons. And it was great show business, with a full cast of characters, a compelling anti-hero, high-level drug traffickers who flipped a sexy mistress, a beautiful young wife in the gallery. It had titillating stories of luxury jets, private zoos, and naked escape with said mistress through an elaborate tunnel and wretched excesses of wealth that would bring a blush to the faces of the most shameless stars of reality TV. There was even a hint of celebrity, as the actor who portrays the defendant in the Netflix drama Narcos, Mexico, made the pilgrimage to see his real-life inspiration. Yes, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman Loera, the infamous jefe of the all-powerful Sinaloa cartel, the godfather of the drug world, as one DEA official styled him, was brought to justice in a trial meant to stand as a major victory in the war on drugs. No fewer than 56 prosecution witnesses gave detailed, sometimes tedious, often gruesome testimony about beatings, tortures, and murders. There was even a suggestion that the jurors might be vulnerable to PTSD, which seemed a tad overwrought. The defense case was mercifully brief. One witness, Guzman, on the advice of his lawyers, chose not to testify in his own defense. It was good advice. The prosecutors would have ripped him to shreds on cross-examination, and he would hardly have made a sympathetic witness. But disappointing in that it deprived us of one crucial dramatic beat in any celebrity trial. In an ideal show business world, Guzman would have taken the stand and delivered a money line. You want answers? You can't handle the truth. More on that below. The jurors took their time, 6 days, deliberating, causing some anxiety for the prosecutors, and even some breathless media speculation that he might get off. All attorneys know that any time you send a case to a jury, you are rolling the dice. Despite your best attempts in voir dire, you never know what baggage an individual juror might bring in with him or her. A grudge against the legal system, sympathy for a charismatic rebel, a tent pitched firmly on a grassy knoll, a hang-'em-high mentality successfully concealed until it emerges full-blown in the jury room. Anything can happen. And the jurors faced a difficult task. To weigh guilt or innocence on 10 complicated charges, including conspiracy to traffic drugs, conspiracy to commit murder, and complicity in running an international criminal organization. Convicting on any one of the counts would send the defendant to prison for the rest of his life. The jury found Guzman guilty on all counts. It was the right call. The evidence was overwhelming. The U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York called the verdict a victory for law enforcement, for Mexico, and for the families who had lost loved ones to drug addiction. All that is true. And yet, in the big picture, none of it mattered. The Guzman trial will do nothing to stem the flow of narcotics into the United States. Don't get me wrong. Convicting Guzman for trafficking literally tons of drugs into the U.S. was a good thing. He's not Robin Hood. He's a killer responsible for untold suffering, surely far more than he's charged with, and if he spends the rest of his life in prison, it will be something like justice. But his capture and prosecution do nothing to ameliorate the American drug problem, and his conviction is likewise meaningless. The reason is simple. By the time of Guzman's capture, escape, and recapture in the farce that made him a celebrity, he had already lost most of his power. He was superfluous, expendable. The critical thing to understand is that Guzman wasn't, and never would be, the sole boss of the Sinaloa cartel. We tend to think of cartels as pyramids, with a single head at the top, but in fact they are more like wedding cakes with several tiers. Guzman was on the top tier, with others, the most important being Juan Esparragosa Moreno, widely rumored to be deceased, the late Ignacio Coronel Villarreal, and a man named Ismael El Mayo Zambada, who has been prominently featured, albeit in absentia, in this trial. A time-tested defense attorney, Maxim, says that if your client is obviously guilty, put someone else on trial. In their opening statement, Guzman's lawyers argued that he wasn't the real boss of the Sinaloa cartel, long the biggest drug traffic organization in the world. Instead, they claimed that honor belonged to Zambada, and he has paid hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes to high-ranking officials in the Mexican government in order to remain, well, in absentia. Witnesses, including Zambada's own brother and son, testified to the same. But nobody calls Mayo Zambada the godfather of the drug world, and that's the way he likes it. You don't see Zambada interviewed in Rolling Stone, trying to launch romances with television stars, or working on a biopic about himself as Guzman did. Zambada is a conservative businessman who prefers to stay behind the curtain. If there is a Don Corleone of Mexican drug lords, it is Ismael Zambada, and his partner Guzman was becoming increasingly problematic. Mob bosses remain in power as long as they're making other people money. Guzman had begun to cost people money. At the start of his downfall, he was suffering huge declines in marijuana profits due to legalization in America. Everyone was, and one of the cartel's responses was to get back into the heroin market for the first time since the 1970s, in order to grab a cut of the American pharmaceutical company's booming opioid addict market. The cartels produced so much heroin that they created a surplus, which, in a reversal of previous policy, they started to sell inside Mexico. Guzman got greedy and demanded a cut of the profits from local dealers in Sinaloa, thereby alienating his own power base. Combine that with his increasingly bizarre antics, and it's clear why he had become a liability to his partners, principally Zambada. Sources in Mexico inform me that Zambada, aging and ailing, has been wanting to take his billions and retire quietly. But he had another problem besides Guzman, two sons who were facing long sentences in the United States. In 2010, Zambada's son Vicente was extradited to the U.S. for drug trafficking and was looking at a potential life sentence. In November 2013, his brother Serafin was arrested in Arizona for conspiracy to traffic cocaine and methamphetamine and faced a sentence of 10 years to life, as well as a $10 million fine. In 2014, it came to light that Vicente had cut a secret plea deal, agreeing to testify against Guzman. In February 2015, Serafin was transferred to an undisclosed location, but there was no record of him in federal custody. It was widely assumed at the time that he, like his brother, needed someone to trade up for, and that it wasn't going to be his father. The increasingly erratic, increasingly public Guzman was the obvious candidate. It is no coincidence that Guzman was initially captured while the Zambada brothers were making their deals. In March 2018, Serafin was sentenced to 5.5 years. He was released last September. Still, Guzman retained enough support, influence, and money to engineer his 2015 daring escape, allegedly accomplished through a near-mile-long tunnel dug under the maximum security prison walls and also under the supposedly unwitting noses of the Mexican army, the federales, and the prison authorities. It was neither daring nor an escape, but rather a bought and paid for departure. Prison surveillance video shows a fully dressed Guzman getting into the shower behind the privacy wall, enough said, in his cell, which blocks the view as he supposedly goes down the tunnel entrance. Despite the testimony of Guzman's former right-hand man, Damaso Lopez, there is still cause to doubt that he ever went into that tunnel. If you can afford $15 million in construction cost and bribes to build a tunnel, you can also afford not to have to use it. It's possible he went out the front door, the same as he did during his first escape in 2001, for which there was also a face-saving official explanation that he went out hidden in a laundry cart. Guzman might actually have remained free if this spectacle hadn't brought so much attention and embarrassment to the Mexican government. The media frenzy brought pressure, especially from the U.S., that forced Mexico to launch an intense manhunt, as well as raids, arrest, and seizures of product targeting the whole Sinaloa organization. In other words, Guzman's shenanigans cost the cartel money. The old truism that there's no such thing as bad publicity is definitely not true for organized crime figures, and for whatever reason, whether he became enamored of his own press clippings or just came to believe his own legend, Guzman started to seek the limelight. He wanted Hollywood to make a biopic about him, and that effort, combined with his infatuation with Mexican soap opera star Kate del Castillo, led Guzman to sit for an infamous interview with the actor Sean Penn for Rolling Stone magazine. The article, which disclosed that Penn and Del Castillo passed through a nearby army checkpoint on their way to the meeting, has been credited with leading Mexican law enforcement to Guzman's location. Let's be real. They already knew where he was. But the publicity helped persuade Zambada and other decision-makers that it was time not just to allow Guzman to be removed, but to demand it. The only condition was that he not be hurt. Five of his associates were killed in the raid that netted him, but Guzman and his assistant were unharmed. This much is sure: Guzman would not have been recaptured or extradited without the permission and cooperation of Zambada and other powerful figures in the cartel and Mexican government. Systemic corruption has been in place for many years. It remains in place, and it is far larger and far more powerful than a single defendant, even the supposed godfather of the drug world. The real godfathers of the drug world sit in comfortable offices, not in a trial dock or a cell. Sure, putting away a bad guy like Guzman is a good thing, but he's only the latest in a long list. To what end? Drugs are more plentiful, more potent, and less expensive than ever. What is the true nature of the drug trafficking machine? What is the depth and width of the corruption that allows it to flourish? Where do the billions of dollars go? How does it provide protection, and who provides that protection? And something else, and maybe this is the truth that we can't handle. Corruption is not the sole property of traffickers and their enablers. We own it, too. We have to ask the question, what is the corruption of the American soul that makes us want the drugs in the first place. Opioids, which are killing more Americans now than either car crashes or guns, are a response to pain. We have to ask the question, what is the pain? Until we ask and answer that question, the drug problem will always be with us. And the trial of the century? Sorry, but it just doesn't matter. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.